time for the Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:07 on Friday, February 14th. This hour, we'll look back at the top headlines in politics and hash the pros and cons with two guests from differing political perspectives. From last night's State of the Tribe address to Governor Walker's proposal to change and amend the tax cut plan in order to get it through the Senate. We'll have lots to talk about this hour. My guests today are Peg Lautenschlager, former Democratic Attorney General for Wisconsin, and a former state lawmaker and former United States Attorney. She's now an attorney at the Bauer & Bach Law Firm in Madison. Peg Lautenschlager, welcome to the Week in Review.
Thank you, Cynthia. Good to be with you.
And Owen Robinson is a columnist at the West Bend Daily News. Welcome, Owen.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. In the annual State of the Tribe address yesterday afternoon, we heard from the chair of the Menominee Tribe, Lori Boivin, who mentioned that the school mascot law that was passed a few months ago would have a damaging effect on Native American children. What's your reaction, Owen Robinson?
Well, I think as far as the State of the Tribe address overall, it was more interesting what she didn't mention. Or talk about, which are much more pressing issues, frankly, this state. But the reality is the law that was in place was, you know, people have to remember the process for that happening was rammed through in the last minutes of the Doyle administration. It was arbitrary and unfair. It was if one person went to a school district and said, I'm offended by your mascot, then that forced a process for bureaucrats in the DPI to make an arbitrary decision of whether they could keep their mascots or not, imposing a large expense on that local community. This measure, frankly, I don't think it goes far enough, but at least it makes it a little bit more fair and puts a little bit more due process in place so that it's fair to everybody involved because everybody has a stake in their local community and their local community's identity.
Mm-hmm. Owen Robinson, I'm just going to pause you because you sound a bit hollow on your phone line, and I'm wondering if you're on a headset or speakerphone, if you could turn it off and talk directly into the handset, and hopefully we can clarify your line in just a moment. Peg Lautenschlager, what's your response?
Good morning. I think my response is somewhat opposite of Owen's. I think when it comes to issues involving civil rights, one of the fundamental principles that we have always followed is that while we have rule by the majority, we also protect the rights of the minority. Here you have a situation where oftentimes symbols as well as the mascots themselves provide really goofy-looking views of or images of somebody who's, say, Native American here in Wisconsin. And so to leave something like that up to the will of the majority and call it due process, I think, is inappropriate. So for those kinds of reasons, I think that we have to be careful of respecting the rights of everyone, recognizing that while we do have rule of majority, that the rights of the minority, particularly when it comes to these sorts of things, discrimination based on things like gender, race, or whatever, need to be looked at in a fashion that doesn't just see who can get the most votes.
Owen Robinson, do we have you back?
Yeah, and hopefully this sounds a little bit better.
You do.
But, you know, and I agree that protecting civil rights is obviously something that is very important that we do. And our normal process in any other venue is that we go through our court system where people have legal protections and there's a due process and there's the ability of the accused to challenge their accusers. There's all those legal precedents that we put in place over the years. The process that was in place that's now been modified was it bypassed all of that. It went through a bureaucracy of state government to decide whether it's going to happen or not, based, and it was up to the accused to prove that they were not guilty.
But Owen, the issue though was never eliminated from the court system. One can always challenge the rulings under Chapter 227, I think it is, of state law, which is essentially our Administrative Procedure Act. So that the actions of DPI could have been challenged by anyone in court. There's just this intermediate step, which would go more toward, I would argue, a fact-finding thing and an analysis as to whether or not a mascot of a certain sort would be in some way discriminatory towards students towards students or anyone, for that matter.
But the reason that process was put in place was, I mean, in reality, to prevent it from ever going to court, because that's a much more arduous process for the people who wanted to change.
I find it interesting.
So what you're asking for, is school districts to have to spend thousands and thousands of dollars to defend themselves through this DPI process, just to then turn around and go through a court process as well.
Well, I find that interesting, only in that, for the most part, people of my party have been concerned that indeed the processes for getting into court have been heightened and exaggerated in terms of administrative control over things, executive branch control over things. And now here is an example of an executive branch issue where they say, let's go through the executive branch first and then go to court, and all of a sudden this becomes onerous on school districts. I can point out numerous examples, particularly in the labor law area, where individuals who would like to seek remedies in court are first forced to go through the Office of State Employment Relations, then go through the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission and the like before they can get to court now. So we are seeing in most cases from this legislature and governor instances where these extra steps are being mandated, where individuals need to go through the executive branch in order to, before going to court, in terms of challenging statutes which might be unconstitutional. It goes on and on. And yet, while these barriers are being placed on those actions, suddenly when it comes to mascots in school, these barriers become unnecessary and overly burdensome. So I think we have to have some sort of a way in which we decide this is the logical route which individuals should be able to take in order to seek redress for grievances. And I just don't think that the position of the governor's office and the legislature on this situation is in any way consistent with their other decisions in terms of seeking remedies.
Well, Governor Walker, moving on to another topic, Governor Walker says that he's still open to working with lawmakers on his $500 million property and income tax cut proposal that passed the Assembly, and he's awaiting action in the Senate. Walker said Wednesday that he doesn't care when the Senate gets to the bill as long as they pass it before they leave for the year, likely sometime in April. Owen Robinson, should the Senate change its attitude about the tax cut proposal, or should the proposal be modified?
You know, at this point, when you're expecting to receive extra money from people that you're already overburdened with taxes, you really have three choices. You can spend it, you can save it, or you can give it back. And what Walker is proposing is a mix of save it and give it back. Some people want to spend it. I would rather, frankly, they give it all back, because we've seen over the years that that rainy day fund has been abused time and time again. When people get in charge, you just want to spend it. So I would rather see it all come back. I don't think the Senate's going to get there. I think Walker is correct that if he gets 99% of what he's looking for, he'll sign off on it. But it could always be a little better.
Peg Lautenschlager.
Well, I have a hard time thinking that in any way this sort of proposal is going to help us with what's the fundamental problem in Wisconsin, and that's getting more jobs. The governor has been woefully neglectful in fulfilling his promises. We've had announcements of other folks going. Reducing property taxes on a home by an average of $131 it's not going to be something which impacts our economy in any meaningful way. Reducing income taxes for the average taxpayer by $46 isn't going to have any meaningful change to most individuals in Wisconsin. Accordingly, I think we need to be looking at a couple of things. First, we need to be looking at our structural debt and how we're going to pay for that. We have created in Wisconsin in the past several years the largest structural debt in our state's history. And as a result of that, we are going to need to look for forward funding mechanisms. So returning all of this money to folks only to set it up for future governors to have to raise taxes in order to fulfill our obligations on that structural debt is I think, silly. Secondly, we do need to do something about training and job training. We are in a situation now where Wisconsin is becoming an island in the Midwest for a variety of reasons, many of which impact job creation. And so recognizing that we need to do something with education in order to ensure that we continue to have a workforce that is capable of filling roles, filling jobs that are open or could be had here in Wisconsin is huge. So I think that, you know, giving us all a check for $100 or $200, granted, that's a huge amount of money for many low-income people, especially the very poor. But on the other hand, giving that sort of money to average citizens versus having a community where there's more full employment, I think many people would pick the latter.
Owen Robinson.
Well, as I said, that when you have extra money, you can spend it, save it, or give it back, and it appears you want to spend most of it. But I always find this a little amusing because we say that, you know, having $130 or $54 isn't going to have a meaningful impact on people's lives. And in the grand scheme of things, it has a little bit, not much. But on the same token, we've spent decades of ratcheting up those taxes by those incremental amounts every year, every budget. We ratchet up a little bit more. And so now we finally have a circumstance where this, bearing in mind, this is also not the first or probably the last tax cut that's going to come out of this legislature, that we've seen our taxes for the first time actually level out or be reduced. And that hasn't happened in a very long time. And frankly, even with that, the state of Wisconsin is still spending more money with every budget than it did the previous budget.
Owen, but that just isn't true. We have lowered
but we're still spending more.
Owen, we have lowered various tax rates for the last two decades. We have put freezes on property taxes. We have done a number of things to lower tax rates. So to just keep proclaiming year after year that taxes only go up and they never go down is just a falsity. Governor Walker's first budget, he himself claimed tax reductions. So to say that it keeps going up and up and we never go down, it's just untrue. And the fact that our budgets oftentimes get bigger has to do more with the fact that we have a growing population, that we have costs that we need to bear. And in fact, perhaps the biggest reason is because we have more and more unemployed people and people who are poor, people who are working but still are below the poverty rate, and the kinds of social security nets which we've put in place for them are costly. And as well, we keep putting people in prisons. That has nothing to do with what our tax rate is and spending. That has to do with ways in which we have chosen to spend our money, and we can lower those costs by simply changing those things around, not by giving a tax rate and then putting it on local governments to try to reduce spending on essential government services.
This is The Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and we're hashing out some of the top news headlines, the top political stories out of the state this week on The Week in Review. Our guests are Peg Lautenschlager, former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin and an attorney at Bauer & Bach Law Firm in Madison, and Owen Robinson. He's a columnist with the West Bend Daily News. We're taking your questions, your comments, and analysis as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. We're talking with Peg Lautenschlager, former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin and an attorney at Bauer & Bach Law Firm, and Owen Robinson. He's a columnist with the West Bend Daily News. We're also taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234 and your emails at talk@wpr.org. Peg and Owen, tensions have been flaring between Republican leaders in the Senate and Assembly. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald criticized Assembly Speaker Robin Voss in a panel about Voss's approach to pushing the tax cut bill that we've been talking about too aggressively, according to Fitzgerald. And Voss has fired back in interviews accusing Fitzgerald of ignoring his requests for meetings. Peg Lautenschlager, what do you make of this apparent conflict in the Republican Party?
I don't know. It's as an outsider and as someone who doesn't know anything on either in terms of either camp, and Owen, I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about this. It's I think totally bizarre, and it's really quite amazing. I think it's fair to say that Republicans have always enjoyed significant party discipline, far more than Democrats. We tend to all have our own ideas and think we're smarter than everyone else on occasion, or whatever it happens to be. But we are very wedded to our positions, and oftentimes don't go along with a group. Here we've got a situation where folks who have historically been very congealed in terms of getting together and saying this is our party line position and we will follow it, suddenly are having these internal disputes. I kind of feel like Wisconsin's becoming the mini-me version of you know, John Boehner's conference nationally. But like I say, I defer to Owen on this one to find out what's going on inside those caucuses.
Owen?
Well, and this is really, a lot of it is related to the fact that, one, we're in an election year, and two, these are very different bodies when it comes to the individual caucuses, where the Assembly, Speaker Voss enjoys a sizable majority. He's not in any real fear of losing that majority in this election cycle, and he has a lot of caucus members that are frankly a lot more conservative than those in the Senate. So they're pushing through legislative actions that they see as conservative or things that they want to go on record for before we get into this election season, things that are popular, like the speed limit bill, which is a trivial thing, but it's something that a lot of people support. So they shove it through so they can say, I voted for that. Whereas in the Senate, Fitzgerald is defending a much more moderate caucus. He's very much in danger of losing that majority with a couple of moderate seats going up for election with strong Democratic contenders. And he's trying to really, and even said it in one interview, saying he wanted to end the legislative season in a non-controversial format. So he's trying to avoid controversial legislation and all. So they're in very different positions of where they are, both in leading those caucuses and leading legislation, bearing in mind that both men want to remain leaders in their parties in their respective areas. So they do have to bow to the will of their respective majorities at times.
What makes me curious, and again, I'd throw this to both of you, is that how, you know, Wisconsin's example is so much, I think, like the federal example right now. And I don't know if it's that groups that historically were oftentimes in the minority, it's, you know, it's easy to kind of come together when you're in the minority, but once you're in the majority, everybody wants their say. Is this something that's institutional, or is this something within the Republican Party between conservatives and more moderates? I don't know. I find it interesting.
I think it's a lot of just pure human nature, in that you do have people who are in the majority for a long time, and you see it regardless of party, regardless of level of government. If they're in power for a long time, they sometimes get a little big for their britches, frankly, and they just want to shove stuff around. So
let's take a call from Dave in Mount Horeb. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. The head bureaucrat, Scott Walker, has proposed an income tax and property tax cut that is going to send money to Washington, D.C. The majority of the money that he is proposing in his tax cut is going to go to the folks that are itemized, and on Schedule C, all that extra money they're going to get is going to be taxed at up to 39.6% to Washington, because we either tax it here in Wisconsin and keep it here, or get taxed in Washington and get sent there. If you want another suggestion, I have one, but understand that when the head bureaucrat cuts the income tax and the property tax, up to 39.6% of that money is headed to Washington, D.C. It's not staying in Wisconsin.
Thanks, Dave. What's your response, Owen Robinson?
Well, characterizing Walker, a duly elected state official, as a bureaucrat is a bit saying where you're coming from there. But, I mean, so basically what you're saying is the fact that we will keep more of our income by not having as high state taxes mean we'll spend a little bit more in federal taxes because we are now taxed on that income. Frankly, I will take that. I'd rather have the more income.
I just have two responses in reply. First of all is, Owen, I think you just called the head of DPI and the folks working for him as a bureaucrat. So there's also a duly elected public official elected statewide. So I'm presuming that Tony isn't a bureaucrat, and the decisions he's making on Indian things aren't either. The other thing I just mentioned is that Scott Walker clearly is following his own agenda, regardless of what the impact is to people in Wisconsin. He has an agenda where he wants to be a tax cutter, where he wants to eliminate the size of state government, and he's doing so to run to create a platform for what I think is going to be a run for president in 2016. We've seen him do things like this where his actions do not inure to the benefit of Wisconsin taxpayers. We have seen it with the light rail funding that had come through. We've seen it with the Medicaid monies that we could have had under so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. We've seen him forego clear benefits to Wisconsin citizens, which would either come in the form of monies coming from the federal government or in the form of our keeping taxes here and not going back to the federal government, as Dave describes. That doesn't fit his narrative in terms of his hopes for higher office. And as a result of it, from my perspective anyway, we as Wisconsin citizens pay.
Sue? Well, a politician with aspirations for higher office is absurd and unheard of, I know. But still it remains. If we get a tax cut of $100 from the state of Wisconsin and we're taxed 39.6% of that back to the federal government, we're still keeping the difference of it, and that's more money in the pockets of Wisconsinites.
We'll talk to Sue in Mequon next. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I've written to both of my state legislators, Ott and Darling, and I asked them that the surplus be used to pay down state debt, make infrastructure improvements, restore public education cuts, and, of course, there won't be any left, put it in a rainy day fund. I don't think our state legislature is at all interested in debt reduction or long-term investment. And lastly, I would say that there's a lot of interest in Republican state legislatures nationally to do a budget on a balanced budget amendment. And here in Wisconsin, I expect there'll be a lot of interest in that. And yet our legislators aren't doing anything about it. Thank you.
Thanks, Sue. Peg, we'll toss that to you first.
Well, Sue in Mequon, you are a brave soul being in Mequon and espousing things like support of public education. And I applaud you for that. My sense is that one of the things, though, that you that comes through to me in your comment is this: the things you are talking about, reducing debt, having a rainy day fund, restoring some cuts to public education, are all ideas which are fundamentally conservative. If we had looked at this nation 50 years ago, those sorts of ideas, and I'd throw in support of infrastructure into that mix too, were all ideas that were espoused by conservatives, particularly the paying down the debt and the investment in long-term structural issues like education or public infrastructure. And the thing is that we have now seen this flip-flop where everything is simply anti-government and anti-doing anything, and as a result, we've become this state that doesn't look at things that inure to the public good, but rather just sort of rugged individualism. And it's interesting to see the way in which that ideological norm, that idea that these kind of wise and sound and thoughtful investments, paying down the debt and then the investments in growth and opportunity in the future, have suddenly become crazed radical ideas that we shouldn't be even thinking about because they somehow smack of big government.
Owen Robinson?
Well, and Sue, thank you for your comment, and I'll back into starting with your last point and the fact that we're not seeing a push from this legislature for a balanced budget amendment. And I think that goes back to my earlier comments that they're really trying to avoid anything controversial as they're running into an election cycle. I suspect as we get into the budget section next year, there may be some interest there. Who knows? But it's something that I would certainly like to see as well. I do think also that when you have quote-unquote extra money, so we have surplus money, that paying down debts is certainly a rational and good thing to do with it. And I think it's something that, frankly, would be good to see us pay down some of our actual debts. Putting it in light, though, in this particular economy where the cost of debt right now is extremely inexpensive compared to historical norms. So if you are going to have debt, and I think there's always a place for debt in any budget, both private or public, to fund capital projects and things like that. But so the question is whether it makes sense to pay down that debt now or if there's some other better purpose for it, given that the interest rates are so low. And then specifically to the rainy day fund, a rainy day fund is something that, as a conservative, I support in concept. In reality, they just don't work very well. And since Wisconsin's rainy day fund was created in 1985, I believe, it has more money in it now than it has in the history since that fund was created. And if you look at some of the absurdity of it, where in like the 2001 to 2003 time frame, that fund had $35 in it. $35. Because whenever they get tight for money at state government, they like to go raid it because they consider it a rainy day. One man's rainy day is not another man's rainy day, and that's where if you leave a pot of money sitting in front of a bunch of politicians who want to spend it, it's never going to last very long.
Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mary Burke says it's too soon to spend Wisconsin's surplus. She says the stock market hasn't been good enough this year to count on sufficient tax collections. Does it seem like a good enough reason not to spend the surplus, Owen Robinson?
Because there are fluctuations in the stock market?
That the market, she says the market isn't healthy enough right now.
Well, and and here's the difference, because her comments were specifically about the stock market, which is not the equivalent of the economy. That's two separate things there. So the fact that my 401k may be fluctuating or does great or not doesn't affect my daily spending decisions because I have an income. So, you know, so it was an interesting way to look at it, I thought, to use that as your barometer whether to use or not. But again, here we have, if those surpluses don't realize as they're projected to, then we pull back. If they do realize more, then we have something else to do. But we have to make decisions based on the best information available, and that's what we have today.
Peg?
Well, first of all, my sense is that when you give people money on tax breaks, you don't get to pull back from that. That happens, and it happens, period, end of story. What Ms. Burke is talking about, and I think rightly so, is that our revenues have indeed increased some, in part because of the revenues which individuals, the income individuals, are obtaining based on stock market the stock market being healthy and vibrant, so that stock sales are earning people more money, that sort of thing. And I do think that we don't know if this is going to be temporary or not. Clearly, we're in an economy that we really haven't seen before in terms of the growing disparity between those who have and those who don't, and yet a healthy stock market and yet somewhat slow job creation numbers, whatever, especially here in Wisconsin. So if you couple the stock market successes and the income boost we've had as a result of that, with the concern that our unemployment is still high here in the state, and indeed we aren't creating the jobs that have been promised, I think we do have kind of a situation where we're not quite sure what's going to happen in terms of revenues. And when that happens, you don't want to be taking what seem to be possible, high revenues, and getting rid of them right away, so the savings makes some sense. As for the rainy day fund, the same discipline that to say that politicians will simply spend it because it's there isn't indeed the truth. I mean, politicians oftentimes keep that money there. We've had some hard economic times since the rainy day fund's creation, and we have indeed drawn on that in order to forego cuts to what some legislators view as necessary services. So the notion of, well, we won't have it at all as a result of that, particularly when we're in a situation where we have this high structural debt, doesn't seem to make good financial sense. If you are going to have all of these loans out there and all of these obligations to spend money in the future, it seems as though when we do have some extra income in our state budget, we ought to be making sure that at least part of that goes toward being there if we need it, as we have to pay off these other debts, or else we're just going to be forced to raise taxes again.
Let's work in one more call before we have to break. Mark in Appleton, you're next. Mark, are you there? Okay. We'll just go right to that break. This is the Week in Review right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guests this week are Peg Lautenschlager, a former Democratic Attorney General for Wisconsin, and now an attorney at the Bauer & Bock Law Firm in Madison. Owen Robinson is a columnist with the West Bend Daily News. We're taking your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk feedback@WPR.org, and you can also comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is The Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and it's time for the Week in Review quiz. You'll call in with your guess, and we will collect all the names of the correct respondents, and we will select a winner at random and announce that winner live on the air later this hour. Here's the quiz, and you want to call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. The question is, former Hollywood child star Shirley Temple passed away this week at the age of 85. She got her first film role at the age of 3 and went on to star in 43 motion pictures before retiring from acting at age 22. She's also the youngest person to receive an Academy Award. We want to know, how old was Shirley Temple when she got her Oscar, her first Oscar? Again, that number is 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email your guests into talk@WPR.org. My guests this week on The Week in Review, Peg Lautenschlager and Owen Robinson. Let's move along to the topic of marriage equality. Democratic Senator Tim Carpenter and Representative Jocasta Zamarripa have introduced an amendment that would repeal Wisconsin's gay marriage ban. This comes after the ACLU sued last week to overturn the ban. Peg Lautenschlager, would you support this amendment?
Yes, I would. I think that it makes sense, and I think Wisconsin acted hastily on a ballot initiative originally that was designed more to bring out conservative voters than anything else. So I think that being in line with other states in the Midwest is important for a variety of reasons. First of all, in terms of human rights reasons and discrimination reasons, but also in terms of economic reasons and things like that.
And what about you, Owen Robinson?
Well, I would not support the amendment, but I'm glad that they're going about this process to do it, because when it was passed the first time, remember our process for amending our Constitution is fairly arduous. It goes through two sessions, voted on by the general public, and had wide public support. So to reverse that decision and change the Constitution back, then I think to go through that same to see if it continues or if it has the public support to change it is the way to go about it. So at least they're going through the right way of going about seeing if that's what Wisconsin wants to do.
And Peg Lautenschlager, what's your response to that and the notion of putting something like gay marriage up to a popular vote, which obviously had to be done in order to make it a constitutional amendment?
Well, let me just say this. First of all, in terms of the popular vote issue, we kind of covered this ground when it came to Native American mascots. The reality is there are certain defined rights which individuals have, and whether or not they are part of the majority or whether or not they are part of the minority, both our state and federal constitutions have protection and guarantees in there. If our state constitution conflicts with what is interpreted, even by this conservative U.S. Supreme Court, as being unconstitutional, obviously then that state constitutional provision will not be followed, because the federal constitution trumps the state constitution in that regard. But, you know, to be continuing to argue over rights of individuals whose sexual orientation is different than mine, who aren't heterosexual, to me is kind of a fundamental waste of government time and money. So I hope that, you know, we get past this, we get over it. As my children would tell me, you know, welcome to the new century, the new millennium, get with it, Mom. And I think Wisconsin's sort of in that position now.
Governor Scott Walker says a Republican-backed bill in the legislature would nullify local living wage ordinances is not part of his agenda. The bill received a hearing in the Assembly Labor Committee on Wednesday and has drawn opposition from officials in Madison and Dane County, both of which have had local minimum wage ordinances since 1999. Owen Robinson, how do you feel about this proposal?
Well, I think the whole living wage, minimum wage issue is pretty. I don't support them. I don't think they're an affront to economic liberty. And in particularly when you talk about Milwaukee's ordinance, the way it was written as a union SOP. I mean, you really have a plan here where if a company becomes a member of the union, they can exclude themselves from the living wage ordinance, whereas other companies don't have that right within the county. So it was really written as a SOP to the unions. And I think that particularly when you see a place like Milwaukee County passing something like this, where they receive the vast majority of their funding from other state residents through shared revenue because of the way they're structured, frankly, I'm sitting in Washington County having to spend that bill, having to spend more for government services in another county than I would in my own county. And I don't think that's a right way to treat state taxpayers.
Peg Lautenschlager?
Well, let me try to do a couple of items here. First of all, is that when we have individuals who are working for less than what is the minimum wage that's being suggested by Milwaukee and Dane counties, the reality is we as taxpayers are subsidizing those folks anyway, or many of those folks, because most of the people who are making less than, say, $10 an hour are people who are single moms, people who are adults who've been in other job markets and the like. And so the reality is whether or not we are subsidizing them by providing child care, what they need when they're working multiple jobs in order to make ends meet, whether or not there's something like Badger Care or Medicaid assisting them, whether there's housing assistance and the like, we as taxpayers are subsidizing those individuals while the employers are using those individuals' work to benefit themselves. So, one, I think those costs exist. It's just how they exist. Secondly, I find it interesting because we have people of more conservative viewpoints who have, when I was serving in Madison and the Democrats were in the majority, it was all about local control, local control, local control. Suddenly, local control is out of the window, and we are looking at we must have things working as a state and not being allowing these localities to determine what is best for their economic growth. So we have that issue that's floating around out there. And then we just have the issue of decency. I listened to somebody last night. My husband and I went out for early Valentine's dinner since we're babysitting grandchildren. So our children can go out for Valentine's dinner tonight. But the fellow sitting next to us was talking about how, you know, most people don't deserve more than $10 an hour based on how they work. And to look at who makes how much and what they get paid for based on how they work or what they do in their work, I think we're skewed right now. So when communities like Milwaukee, which have economic hardships, say we need our workers to be able to make this bottom level wage makes sense. As for the union argument, the reality is that most unions have contracts in place that are going to pay workers more than that minimum wage, even the upped minimum wage that is being supported in Milwaukee and Dane counties. So the notion that somehow if you unionize you can get by with paying your workers less in reality isn't going to be true.
But that's actually what's written into the ordinance for them to be able to do. So if it wasn't written in there, why was it written in there? But to come back to your point about local control, I think that's a very valid argument, because I do think we have to give very deferential treatment to local control versus where state rules are, bearing in mind that county governments are an extension of state government, and that so the state has a much more vested interest in the management of those counties versus municipalities. There's different levels of government. But I think that whenever you weigh that, you have to balance that local control argument and wanting people to have local control of what's going on in their community, which is vital, with the ramifications on the rest of the state. So when you talk about what Milwaukee County's doing, not only are you talking about the fact that it's other state residents who are funding most of that, having to reach into their pockets and decline their standard of living in order to support Milwaukee County, but you're also talking about having this patchwork of minimum wage laws around the state that businesses have it's a regulatory burden for them to comply with or to figure out how to do. So it's, it has other ramifications that reach well beyond Milwaukee County, and that's when it makes sense for state to get involved when it's involving the rest of the state.
Any response, Peg?
Oh, well, I guess number one is in terms of the patchwork, I don't disagree with you with the patchwork. I'd like to see the minimum wage raised in Wisconsin to the Milwaukee or Dane County levels statewide. It would be easier. But I don't see that happening, and I do think that this local control and people having control of their own economies matters. Secondly, in terms of I don't find counties to be simply an extension of state government. They have the authority to tax, they elect officials separately, independently, and the like. And I think, you know, we're not New Jersey in that way. But I think, too, that, again, that still ignores that argument that when you have a considerable number of people working at these sub-living wages, we as taxpayers, no matter where we live in the state, are funding them. And we are funding the businesses that benefit from their work at a less than living wage. So to me, it's a question of are we going to fund them by providing services and allowing these businesses to use their labor at a substandard wage, or are we going to demand a living wage and not fund all these social programs and not fund these businesses, essentially, who want to pay the substandard wage? So if we look at it that way, I think based on the integrity of people and based on the model of how we would like things to work in our economic system, pay folks so that they can live, period, end of story.
And earlier you made the observation of your neighbor at dinner who was disparaging people's wage, saying they're not worth it, and now you're calling those wages substandard. But that's by your standards, not necessarily by the standards of the people doing those jobs or the people paying for those jobs or, frankly, the value of those jobs. There are some jobs that are, frankly, worth more than others. That's how an economy works. The key is to have income mobility, where people can start at a low wage and work their ways up, which used to be the American dream, to be able to work your way to the middle class or higher through your hard work and dedication, sweat and intelligence and everything else you could do. By propping up a floor wage that is well above what is entry level, that forces businesses to do things like automate. I mean, why do you think you see automated checkout lines at the grocery stores and all now?
I don't think it has to do with minimum wage. I think it has to do with making that middle to which you want everybody to be able to aspire. And that's, I think, where our problems are coming in. Our economy was healthiest when we had a minimum wage, which in real-term dollars was more than double what it is now. And now we see that our economy has these struggles, in large part because the poor are getting poorer. And they're getting poorer because we are allowing businesses to underpay them for what would be a living wage. And to say that something under $20,000 is in some way a living wage, I think, is pushing it.
When I was working for college as a teenager, that was a great wage.
Yeah.
The Wisconsin Senate passed a scaled-down bill that would allow attorneys to appeal rulings blocking state laws. The original proposal passed by the Assembly in June would have gone farther, allowing lawyers to nullify rulings that block statutes from taking effect. Republicans introduced the bill after Dane County judges struck down portions of Governor Walker's collective bargaining restrictions and voided GOP photo identification requirements for voters. Peg Lautenschlager, I'm wondering, how would this watered-down version of the bill affect the judicial process?
Well, I don't think it's going to affect the judicial process that's currently in place, as I think you know. Right now in the Eastern District of Wisconsin and Federal District Court, Judge Adelman will be arriving at a decision involving whether or not the law that was passed meets constitutional muster. Obviously, the legislature can consider whether or not it's going to make changes based on that ruling and appeals that will almost certainly follow to determine if restrictions on voting can still survive that constitutional scrutiny. I think that there is some logic to waiting for the court's decision, because I think if another law is passed and there are those who believe that it's not sufficient to rise to constitutional scrutiny. There'll be yet another lawsuit, which will then wait for the first lawsuit, and we'll get into sort of a giant legal traffic jam, for want of a better term, in terms of how things are going. On the other hand, obviously having these more restrictive laws are very important to the majority party in terms of limiting voter access during upcoming elections. So I presume most Republicans are going to want to see at least something pass prior to the 2014 general elections.
Owen?
Well, and I get why the Republicans are doing it. It's frustrating for them to pass these substantial pieces of legislation and have a Dane County judge, a judge elected by local Dane County residents, affect the entire state by holding up that legislation. So I understand why they're doing it. Frankly, I don't support the measure. I think that while I would rather it move more rapidly, I think that our judicial process, I mean, if you have a rogue county judge who's just shooting down everything, that's why we have appeals courts, that's why we have the Supreme Court. I'd rather see it work through the normal judicial process.
And the other thing about it, too, is that many of these cases, we're getting outside counsel and not using the state AG's office for representation. So every time we pass another law and somebody challenges it, it becomes expensive for taxpayers.
Thousands of emails and other documents uncovered during a John Doe investigation into a former aide of Governor Walker's, or then a county, executive, Scott Walker, will be released on February 19th. The governor says he doesn't know if any of his own emails will be included. The emails were seized from Kelly Reinfleisch, who pleaded guilty in 2012 to doing campaign work for Walker while at her Milwaukee County government job. Owen Robinson, what information might we find in these emails, if anything?
I think you'll probably find a lot of back and forth and probably some embarrassing phraseology, and we'll move on. Obviously, there other than what was used for Reinfleisch herself and everything, that there wasn't anything of a criminal nature in there. But frankly, if these are public documents of communication between public officials, then they should be public. So if they wrote something embarrassing, they'll have to own it.
Peg?
I agree with Owen on that. But secondly, I think, you know, what is to be found is difficult to predict. I know that when I was working on a case that was in Dane County Circuit Court involving limited access to the Capitol and trying to regain what was normal access prior to 2011, many of the individuals who were working in the Walker administration, including the Secretary of the Department of Administration, were very sparse in their emails. In other words, they, I think, were very aware that emails can come back to haunt you, that they can be retrieved in virtually all cases, and as a result, very little was written. And in fact, one official acknowledged under oath while testifying that why would you put something in email when it might be able to come back to haunt you? So, I don't know if we're going to find anything in those emails or not. Clearly, there may be some problems. I don't know. I hope we don't become another New Jersey where, everybody talks about how there's nothing there, but then piece by piece as things are uncovered, we find something more. But, it's hard to tell at this point what's going to happen. But February 19th will be a big day, and obviously it's going to be a big day, or else the Republican Governors Association wouldn't be doing the media dump that they're going to do on that day in terms of anti-Mary Burke ads and pro-Scott Walker ads.
Well, it's time to reveal the answer to our Week in Review quiz. The question this week, former Hollywood child star Shirley Temple passed away at the age of 85. She got her first film role at the age of 3. We wanted to know, how old was she when she got her first Oscar? The answer is she was 6 years old. And our winner is Jean in Appleton. So we will contact Jean and let her know that she's our winner. Shirley Temple was given a special juvenile award for her contribution to screen entertainment in 1934. After her acting days, she went on to a successful political career, serving as a U.S. ambassador to Ghana and to Czechoslovakia, and among many other roles. She died Monday in California. Peg Lautenschlager, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Always a pleasure, Cynthia.
And Owen Robinson, thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you, Peg.
Yeah, good to talk to you both.
Peg Lautenschlager is a former Democratic Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin. She's now an attorney at Bauer & Bach Law Firm in Madison. Owen Robinson is a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. Thanks to Bill Martins, Christy Taylor, and Robin Cherry. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network.
Tonight, trip into bed, you hop and dream away on the good ship, Lola.